Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Amy Jurevich, a show where we share stories about science, technology, and the future of our environment. Government surveillance and data collection are two of the most controversial aspects of our modern, technology-centered society. These concerns were significantly heightened when the news broke that the federal government was tapping AI and software company Palantir to compile a database with information on all Americans. This database will collect all information currently in government hands and put it in one place, raising security and privacy concerns for millions of Americans. Joining me now is New York Times reporter Shira Frankel. Shira, welcome to All Sides.
Thank you for having me.
Can you tell me what types of services Palantir provides? What does this company do?
Palantir is a company that's in the business of data, organizing data, using AI to analyze the data and draw conclusions. It essentially comes in and it sort of excels at working with people that may not have a background in understanding their data or being able to organize their data. And it takes all that and then it presents it in a way that even someone who really has no technical background whatsoever can easily understand and draw conclusions from.
Now, what does the federal government want to do? I said in the introduction that they want to take information that a bunch of different agencies have and put it all in one place. On the surface, that makes sense. Why not? If you have all this information, put it in one place. That sounds innocent enough.
Yeah. And I'll just note for a moment that a number of administrations led by Democratic and Republican presidents have talked about doing this. They've talked about how there's so much confusion in the U.S. government because our data is organized across so many different systems at so many different agencies. And we've had them say, look, wouldn't it be so much easier and simpler if all this data was just in one centralized place? Now, Trump has come in and said he wants to do this to eliminate waste. He put out an executive order in March where he said that he wants to take down the silos in data between government agencies, and he sees that as an important move for his government. I think where the problem here, or the question here really lies, is in the problems that have been raised by people in the national security establishment, privacy advocates, civil liberties groups, to what actually happens when you take all this data that's been kept separate all these decades and put it all in one sort of central repository.
And what would happen? I mean, what do they hypothesize?
They hypothesize a lot. I mean, so you talk to national security experts and they'll tell you you're basically creating a huge sort of bullseye target for any Iranian.
Oh, I see. A one-stop shop for a hacker. Yeah.
Exactly. You're based in China, Russia, hacking for the government, and you normally had to go to 12 different places to try and hack and achieve this level of data. Now you're basically giving them one target. So you have people from the national security establishment saying this is a terrible idea, and you have privacy advocates who say that, you know, there's really been a contract between U.S. citizens and the government for a long time that when we give data over to the government towards one purpose, it'll be used towards that purpose. There's actually a Privacy Act in place that's connected to this. You file taxes to the U.S. government because you have to file taxes, and you give them over a huge amount of data about your personal life when you do that. And the understanding is that the government is using this to make sure you adequately filed your taxes. Now, if that information then gets used by, I'm using specifically the Trump administration here because he's the one interested in doing this, but he goes in and he says, right, I'm now going to use this tax information to figure out whether this particular American has family members that are undocumented or whether they themselves are an undocumented person, and therefore I'm going to use it to achieve my sort of agenda around immigration. There's a sense among privacy advocates that this is a break sort of in Americans' privacy, a break in the contract that we have with government over our data.
Well, and then another thing that's being brought up is that the founder of Palantir, Peter Thiel, was a major donor to President Trump and Vice President Vance. Does this raise concerns that this company was chosen for this project because of that, like a backroom deal?
So I'll just give both sides of this. I think if Palantir were sitting here speaking to you, they would say that they have had contracts with Democratic and Republican Party led White Houses, and that their current CEO, Alex Karp, is publicly sort of spoken about being a Democrat. I will also say in my reporting that, of course, Peter Thiel, who co-founded that company, is very, very outspoken about his support for Trump, and that under the Trump administration, Palantir has seen a huge rise in contracts. They've had over $113 million already awarded in contracts and close to $1 billion that's been promised and allocated but not yet given to them. So Palantir is certainly doing well under this Trump administration. Mm-hmm. And a number of people that were in DOGE, the Department
Government Efficiency. Yeah.
Thank you so much. I can't remember the full acronym.
Yeah.
A number of people that joined DOGE had previously worked at Palantir, previously had ties to either Thiel or Karp or Elon Musk. And so you do have this sense that this is a company which, you know, may have a bit of an advantage with the Trump administration.
Well, where DOGE comes in, they're spending more money. I mean, they're giving more money to Palantir to do this with more data and like kind of streamline it. But is it spending money now to save money later rather than having all of the data spread out?
You know, that's a good question, right? I think it depends on what agency you're talking about. There are some agencies like the Department of Treasury that has been talking about organizing their data for some time. The IRS specifically has been talking about a way to organize their data. And when we did this reporting and we talked to people within the Treasury, they said, look, we had people in Treasury that were trying to kind of get a better system around our IRS data. We are now working with Palantir to do this, and Palantir might be brought on as a permanent kind of partner in this. And so they would make the argument that they're relying on Palantir's, you know, years and years of expertise here. Now, there's other parts of government, the Department of Homeland Security, where ICE, one part of ICE has been using Palantir for a long time. But since the Trump administration came in, another part of ICE, the part that actually goes out and sort of collects people off the street that are undocumented and deports them, they've never used Palantir before. Mm-hmm. And a number of people who actually worked in that organization told us they don't understand why they need Palantir or why you would spend millions of dollars bringing Palantir into that specific part of ICE.
ICE doesn't need more organized information. Maybe they, I don't know.
Well, this is getting a little into the weeds, but yeah. So the ICE that previously used Palantir was the part of ICE that did investigations. I spoke actually to quite a few people who had worked closely with ICE on things like child trafficking, right? So Palantir was very, very good at looking at data in the Department of Homeland Security, finding patterns in people who were trafficking in children and locating them. And that was considered very, very high priority. And quite a bit of money was spent, you know, working with Palantir on this very, very sort of important goal for the U.S. government to stop child traffickers. The ERO, the other side of Palantir, the part that goes out and physically collects people, previously, you know, when they've had requests to budget, according to the people we spoke to, they've wanted more people to work with them physically on the street, to go out into what people kind of know as those ICE raids, when you see those videos of people out in the street physically detaining people. They've said they want to hire more people to do that. They have not previously spoken about a lack of data or an inability to kind of locate people, according to some of the sources that we spoke to who have been in the Department of Homeland Security for years.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News, and this is Tech Tuesday. We're talking about Palantir and its contract to create a new federal database with Shira Frankel, a reporter for The New York Times. Has Palantir ever offered people the ability to opt out of being in its databases with the government, or is that not really possible?
Well, so that wouldn't be possible because Palantir doesn't play that role. Palantir is not interfacing between Americans and the U.S. government. I think the best way to think of Palantir is almost like, you know, Google Docs or Gmail, which most people use, right? It's a software system. So their client is the U.S. government. What the U.S. government does with them is really, you know, it's at the hands of the U.S. government. So I think the right way to think about that is, does the U.S. government give Americans the ability to opt out of giving data? Does the U.S. government give us as Americans the choice to say, hey, maybe we've given you this data before, but now we want that. We want you to no longer have it. We want the ability to erase data from your systems. I mean, I think the relationship here is really between Americans and their perceived contract, their perceived, you know, trust in the U.S. government. Palantir is really just a software tool that's being sold to the U.S. government to organize all this data.
Now, there's been a lot of news every single day of the Trump administration. So I would say that the idea of Palantir has hit the news in some aspects, but it's not been everywhere. There have been a number of supporters of the president who took to social media to air their displeasure about this decision, his executive order. Have you heard from a lot of people since your story came out related to this, wanting more answers from the Trump administration about the use and expansion of Palantir and the data?
Yeah, to be honest, I've been surprised. I've had members of Congress reach out. I've had local government representatives, Americans, just citizen Americans reach out. And I've been listening to some of the podcasts that have come out from really some kind of far right supporters or previous supporters of President Trump, who have said that this is not a part of his agenda that they support. It's actually something they're concerned about.
Now, you did write a little bit about some groups thinking about filing lawsuits over this to block data access. Where does that stand?
There are currently, at last count, we saw dozens of lawsuits that have been filed against the Trump administration and against DOGE specifically for what they believe to be kind of the consolidation, a collating of data across different agencies. And some of the lawsuits that I think were most interesting were the ones that looked at people that have already been deported from the United States. And they have made this argument, and of course, this still has to be tried in court. So, I don't have any special insight. I'm waiting for these trials to get underway, but they're going to be arguing in court that people were deported, American people who were in America were deported based on information that they gave to one agency that was then given to the Department of Homeland Security. So, for instance, a person may have provided information as part of a welfare system in order to get, some type of welfare support in order to help take custody. I think in one case of an unaccompanied minor, they provided information to the government to say, hey, we can in fact provide a home for this unaccompanied minor that's entered the United States. And then that information that they filed was somehow used by the Department of Homeland Security to arrest and deport them. And so the lawsuits that we're seeing in this case is looking at this kind of tricky subject of, again, like data given towards one purpose that then gets used towards another purpose.
Interesting. And there is a one of the key products of Palantir that you mentioned in your article is called Foundry, and at least four more federal agencies now use this. So is that like a data organizing product? Is that what it does?
Yeah, that's you can think of it like that. There's a lot of very wonky words that get described, that get used to describe Foundry, and I have been trying to just get people to think of it as a data organization system. It uses AI. It's not, I don't mean to make it sound like they're just putting things in an Excel spreadsheet because it's really, really not that. It's an AI-backed tool that really helps draw conclusions, find patterns in data. And it is used widely across the government, and it's been used for everything from, the easiest example I can kind of point to is the CDC. When the CDC wanted to help streamline vaccine distribution in the United States, they turned to Palantir and they were like, right, we need one system that can look at everything from like virus hotspots, like where do we need to get the vaccines, to physically, how long does it take to get there? Will it stay at the right temperature to remain viable and active when it arrives there? Do we need to quickly pivot if there's an outbreak of COVID somewhere else? I mean, it's a system that's able to be very maneuverable like that.
Wow, so it's not just names and social security numbers. I mean, we're talking logistics here too.
Yeah, it is. It's the company, when it gives demos on this, often stress it's this AI-backed sort of data system that's able to quickly help you draw conclusions from data.
Yeah. Now, the executive order that would create this intersharing of data that the Trump administration has, does Congress need to be involved at all? Does it require any approval from Congress? Can Congress have a say here?
That is a good question. I don't think anyone knows is the problem. I've been trying to figure that out myself as I've spoken to members of Congress this week because they are sort of probing whether or not they have a say in all this. There is a Privacy Act in place in the United States, and there is a sense that this data should be siloed in the agencies that it's currently in. That being said, there's already been some blurring of the lines, as I mentioned earlier, and in our reporting in the New York Times and elsewhere, we've seen emails in which data was shared between the Department of Homeland Security and specifically ICE and the Social Security Agency, again, towards the goal of deporting people. And so there's already been a merging of data where there previously hasn't been. And one thing that kept kind of coming up in my conversations with members of Congress is that once you merge data, it's really hard to then unmerge. Anyone who's I don't know if anyone here has ever accidentally done this, like with a Google Doc or whatever, where you've like put in a bunch of things and then you've all of a sudden remembered, oh God, I needed to like, designate which came from which source. It's really hard to go back in time and do that. And so there's this question that's come up among many of the people I've spoken to where if Trump were to issue an executive order, and this very much would be, again, the Trump administration's decision to merge data, And they did it because all these different, you know, previously separate sets of data were all on the Foundry system. So it would be pretty straightforward for them to then merge it. If they were to do that, let's say Congress were to try and kind of spring into action. I think every American knows how slow Congress is to act and especially to understand its own power here. So I can't imagine anything would happen very quickly. And there is a sense that it could happen quite quickly. And then, you know, there would be no real way to kind of stop it once it was done.
And then I just wanted just to end with an interesting quote that you had in your story, because it said in an interview from last year, Alex Karp, who is the chief executive of Palantir, he said that the company's role was to, quote, the finding of hidden things by sifting through data, which is interesting. That's an interesting quote to me, because you can see a positive and negative in that, where he can find things that will help, move vaccines around the country faster. But also finding hidden things, that sounds like a violation of privacy.
Yeah, I'm curious about his views on privacy. I've read his, he's published a book, which I've read, and I've listened to some of his recent speaking engagements. And he is a person who, and I'd love to ask him this, but he is a person who seems to really see it as his goal to kind of advance Western civilization and, you know, this kind of America first idea, and that it's so important for America to be strong in the world is kind of what we've heard him say. And I really want to ask him, you know, is it okay with you if it's at the expense of some privacy? Is it okay with you if it's at the expense of some previous things? He has come out and spoken about our article and kind of pushed back against this idea that Palantir would be creating some kind of surveillance state. And again, he didn't answer any of our requests for comment, and we did reach out multiple times asking him to comment for the story. But I guess I would want to ask, you know, look, we didn't ever said that Palantir was creating a surveillance state. What we did say was that the Trump administration has been public about the need and the want to combine data, and what they might do with that might look something like a surveillance state, according to privacy advocates. And I'd want to know if Karp was okay with that, or if he just as a business that's selling software to the Trump administration would step back and say, you know, it's up to them to use this software as they want.
Well, that was New York Times reporter Shira Frankel. Shira, thank you so much for joining me. Thank you for your time today.
Thanks for having me on.
And coming up, we're going to be talking about Substack, a platform gaining popularity, and one of its commentators is calling it a new source for new enlightenment. That's when Tech Tuesday continues from all sides on 89.7 NPR News.
Planet Money helps you understand the economy. We find the people at the center of the story.
Garbage in New York, that was like a controlled substance.
We show you how money influences everything.
Tell me what you like by telling me how you spend your money.
And we dig until we get answers.
I had a bad feeling you're going to bring that up.
Planet Money finds out. All you have to do is listen. The Planet Money podcast from NPR.
And 7:45 during Morning Edition on 89.7 NPR News.
The Trump administration is urging Americans to have more babies. They've proposed some ideas from the pronatalism movement, a $5,000 baby benefit, a motherhood medal for having at least six children. Those of childbearing age cite a number of reasons why they're waiting to have a family, including money worries and a generational shift in priorities. Should the government be enticing Americans to have more babies? That's tomorrow on All Sides with Amy Jurevich from 10 to noon on 89.7 NPR News.
Support for WOSU comes from listeners and from Wolf's Ridge Brewing, a downtown Columbus family-owned craft brewery and restaurant, and its sister restaurant, Understory, located along the Olentangy River Trail in Old North Columbus. Info at wolfsridgebrewing.com.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday from All Sides with Amy Jurevich, a show where we share stories about science, technology, and the future of our environment. Substack is a media platform that allows creators to publish and share content, including newsletters, videos, essays, and more. The subscription-based platform is gaining popularity, with some people saying it might be the new Twitter. Tech expert Peter Lydon is the creator of The Great Progression, 2025 to 2050, a series of keynote talks and Substack essays, and a forthcoming book of the same name. He recently published an article titled, Substack is like the Royal Society of the 21st Century for the New Enlightenment. Welcome to All Sides, Peter.
Great to be here. Again, I've been there, I think, before.
Well, welcome back. I'm happy to have you. So for someone who has no idea what Substack is, can you give us your elevator pitch on why someone should check it out?
Well, to my mind, Substack is kind of the intellectual hub of the internet right now. You had mentioned kind of relation to the old Twitter. It is, in my mind, it superseded Twitter. It's really collected a really high quality group of people who go way beyond tweets. You can actually do essays of whatever length you want, actually. You can do any kind of format you want. Think of it as kind of, for those that understand what a blog is, it's a very amorphous space that you can write. Think of it as essays or articles or newsletters if you want to do it. And you can see it on the web or through the app of Substack, but it also pushes out email to whoever wants to follow whoever you are. So instead of going to Twitter and you're seeing a little tweet and you're wondering what the heck more is going on, you get an email in your box if you want, and you can read it every morning or whenever they publish. And you can also see it on an app on a phone or an iPad, or you can also see it on the web for that matter. But it's essentially knitting together. The real thing, what it's doing, is knitting together an incredible network of thinkers in all different kinds of fields that are really coming up with some of the most interesting ideas about what's going on in the world today, where is it going, and what we should do. And it also is a very diverse and pluralistic space. And so you're actually seeing very smart people on all sides of political equations or all sides of different issues talk thoughtfully and in depth and cross talk to each other and kind of comment back and forth. And so it's become a really, really interesting space. I will say, as someone I've been around since the early days of the internet, I worked at Wired Magazine with the founders. I mean, I've been watching the last 30 years of tech, and I would say right now, and I read a ton of media because I was kind of a former journalist. To me, I spent about half my time. What I read now is through Substack, not through, I mean, I'm still reading the New York Times, or I'm still, you know, checking The Economist and various kind of mainstream issues. But I will say, really what's driving me and what's really making me excited about new ideas, big ideas, getting ahead of the curve on stories, it's basically Substack. And it's attracting not just, and it's now hitting a critical mass. I mean, it's just growing leaps and bounds, and it's attracting really some of the best writers out there. I mean, people like Paul Krugman left the New York Times because he was too constrained on what he was doing there, the economists and columnists, and he's got a booming one going on Substack. But there's a lot of what you would see as famous people from journalism moving over, but also academics or tech people like myself or all kinds of authors are now going. I mean, it's just really really exciting kind of space. And what it does to incentivize those who are creating this stuff is it monetizes it, or can monetize it. You can publish a lot of free stuff. A lot of pretty much all my essays and all my interviews are free to anyone who wants to follow it. But then you can actually charge people for those to get access to those essays if you want to go that route, which some do. Or you can charge it for, let's say, having a group video, like through Zoom, or they have their own kind of video inside the app. Or you can have all kinds of different ways that you could monetize it too, and makes it easy. So Substack solves the back end of supporting writers, thinkers, intellectuals in these endeavors. And because of that, it's created this, just supercharged the environment and made it a fascinating place right now to read about it, anything you want to read about now.
Now, Substack does have an anti-censorship stance, which has resulted in some controversy. There's white nationalists, Nazis, anti-Semites publish content on this platform. Do you feel that that's just a part of the marketplace of ideas? Is Substack taking the right stance in being anti-censorship?
Well, from my point of view, for example, and I read a lot, and I'm involved in a lot there. I don't come across any of that stuff. Mm-hmm. One of the things that's interesting is it's not an algorithm. it's not like Substack is pushing anything to you. You make all the choices as a consumer. So you say, I want to follow this person. I want to follow that person. I don't want to hear from anybody else except who I'm choosing for. Now, what that allows you, and in that ecosystem, there's all kinds of people. I mean, you mentioned a few, which I haven't come across them, but that's probably true. That probably is something like that. But what it has allowed for me, as someone who does want a wide range of perspectives, even perspectives I don't agree with, is it has allowed me to pick and choose who I'm listening for. And it's really enriched my understanding of what's going on in the world now. And so I have, for example, I'm coming more from a left to center side. I'm based in the San Francisco Bay Area, been in the tech world for a long time. But to be fair, I'm probably listening, you know, probably a third or more of the people I follow, I would categorize more right of center or more conservative. And they're kind of opening up whole worlds and ways of thinking respectfully that I can tune into. And they're kind of listening to my stuff, too. So there is a kind of an interesting cross-fertilization that you just really don't get. Like if you just subscribe to even mainstream magazines are usually tailored to one kind of person thinking or mainstream kind of news like that. This is really actually a diverse way to go. Now, do you have to tolerate some kind of stuff on the fringes? That may be true. I personally, it hasn't polluted or gotten in the way of anything I've been trying to do. And I found the experience actually really excellent. Way better than, by the way, social media that gets pushed at you at what they think you want.
Right.
It's like, no, I know what I want. I seek it out. I get it. I subscribe. Many of it are the free version, so you don't have to get overburdened with money. But those that you really appreciate and want to go more in depth with or support their work, you can, you know, put in a modest amount, you know, $10 a month or something like that.
Now, in your article, Substack is like the Royal Society of 21st century of the 21st century for the new Enlightenment. You make the claim that Substack could create an impact as drastic as the Enlightenment. Can you explain that in a little more detail?
Well, it's not that. Let me explain it in a little more detail.
Mm-hmm.
So you got to remember where I'm coming from. I'm coming from the San Francisco Bay Area. I've been in the tech world for 30 years. I'm telling you what AI, the arrival of AI in this form as it is now and the acceleration of what it's going through right now is the biggest technological impact thing I've seen in my lifetime. And that includes the internet or a lot of these previous revolutions. We are really going through an epic change in our technological foundation, what's going to do the economy, what it's going to do ultimately society. And ultimately, I think it's going to have civilization level scale changes over the course of the 21st century. It really is. And there's a few other ones like this. There's bioengineering, which is kind of gets into genetic engineering and that kind of stuff. And we got we're shifting to clean energy rapidly in many ways. There's a bunch of technological, world historic technological changes that are going on around us right now. And because of that, from my perspective, it is going to fundamentally change the economy and ultimately society. Now, if you go back to parallels of where have we seen other things like this in history, one really clear example of that is what happened in the Enlightenment, which is roughly think of it as it's like 1680 to 1800. So it's kind of the 18th century, the 1700s, kind of that period. And in that period, mostly in Western Europe, but also a little bit here in the U.S., we had fundamental innovations, like we invented mechanical steam engines, we invented the Industrial Revolution, we invented financial capitalism, we invented representative democracy here in the United States. We invented it, you know, wholesale, and we invented the nation state. I mean, some very profound inventions that had civilization scale impact, and that in many respects we're still working, living within today. That's the level of change that those technologies and those shifts happen. I'm actually making an argument that we're in a similar situation now. Now, if that's the case, to kind of deal with that kind of level of change at that scale and that profundity, you need people to really be thinking fresh and clean and kind of forward thinking about this. And so I'm trying to say, well, you're going to listen to like 80-year-old senators in, you know, D.C. who are going to try to figure out how to navigate the new world of AI and rework the economy to work for everybody over the long haul around AI? No, of course, those guys are, you know, they're not focused on that. So you're trying to think, where would you look now? And, you know, would you go to a traditional think tank that's backed by some billionaire? Or would you go to the political parties that are all, you know, trying to think about the next election? I think what you're looking at is a kind of a very fluid, open, pluralistic, meritocratic intellectual hive. And that's the closest thing I can see now in the world right now is Substack. And so although, you know, pushing it a little bit farther to say it's like the Royal Society back in the Enlightenment, the way those intellectuals at that time who were thinking about the new ways forward. They were writing letters to each other back in those days in the nascent national postal systems that was just being born. And they were printing books on the kind of early printing press days to kind of share their ideas. There was a kind of a communications revolution. Newspapers were starting then and communicating what was happening in London to what's going on in Paris. It was a kind of a system then. The Royal Society was rooted in England at the time, but it connected up all the intellectuals of Europe at that time, including and the U.S., like Ben Franklin. It connected all the intellectuals at that time. It cross-circulated and kind of they could argue together. They could write letters together. They could critique each other's books at that time. I would say, what's the parallel to that now? And I'm just offering that could be Substack. And because you are actually finding that kind of level of conversation going in depth every day. And if you haven't tried it, you should really check it out, because I think it's going to have an important impact on what's happening here in the next 5 to 10 years, where we're really going to have to move fast on how we're going to restructure a lot of things around these really profoundly world historic technologies, these profoundly powerful world changing technologies that we're just starting to get understand right now.
This is All Sides in Tech Tuesday on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about the rise of Substack with Peter Lydon, the creator of The Great Progression. So in your view, Substack will allow for a movement you're calling The Great Progression. Can you explain that to me as well?
Well, I'm describing it beyond Substack, but basically what I am looking at right now, and I have this Substack series, which is kind of weekly essays, but I also have a book contract with HarperCollins. It's going to be coming out, the book version of this. It actually got the global rights. They want to push it around the world. I do a lot of keynote speaking around this too. Anyhow, the concept here is that these are world historic technologies that are fundamentally game-changing technologies. They're like general purpose technologies that are going to give humans a step change in what we can do, similar to electricity and the printing press and, you know, the wheel. I mean, we've literally been through these step changes. We're at that level of profound change is coming to these 21st century technologies, particularly AI. If that's the case, I'm saying there is the potential here for a burst of progress. Usually these technologies, when they finally settle in, any of them, electricity, go through the internet was another good version of this. They essentially, once people kind of wrap themselves around it, the economy starts to change, the society changes, you watch this burst of progress built around these new technologies. I'm saying the next 25 years, we're in for that. It's not inevitable. Bad things can happen with technology. You can move them in different ways. But I would say the potential is there to see harness these technologies, particularly AI, and really more fundamentally reinvent America and create a much better world going forward. And I think we could we do this. And what I'm exploring in this series and in this book and also through these talks is all the ways we can start roughing out what I'm saying is the grand new narrative, new grand narrative of what could happen in the next 25 years, similar to what happened in the Great War, World War II. We saw a boom of great progress from the war up through the 50s and 60s. I think we're in another version of that. Right now, America could go through, if we do the right things, if we harness this, if we spread the wealth differently, you know, drive it in through the whole society, we could really make a different kind of America, one that works much better for everybody over the long term. And I actually do think it could have implications for cracking a model for the rest of the world. And that's the big idea behind this, the Great Progression. And I think there's a lot to be said there. It's not inevitable, but it's possible. And that's what I think we need to start wrapping our heads on. What would it take to pull this off? And because it's now within reach.
What do you make of the United States versus the rest of the world, particularly China, when it comes to AI? Do you think the United States is going to be able to lead the way, or do you think we're going to get leapfrogged by another country?
Well, right now, the United States is absolutely in the lead of AI. I mean, I've been in this AI space watching this for 30 years now. And there's no question the U.S. is ahead on most fronts, but China is a fast follower, and they have a kind of determined kind of long-term strategic kind of way to kind of think about building around it. So, but it is ours to lose in that respect, that lead, and it's one of the big things that's coming up now, both in the tech world, but also in our politics, from both parties, actually, is to what extent we need to maintain that advantage, you could say, or that kind of front edge, leading edge of AI. I actually think that the way that the United States, in an open, relatively open, relatively more democratic, relatively more pluralistic society is a better one to kind of explore all the different possibilities of AI and how to use it than one that's controlled by, you know, very, you know, basically totalitarian, certainly authoritarian kind of regime where it's a total top-down thing. The AI in the hands of, a kind of, let's say, the Communist Party over there would be a very different AI, meaning surveillance society, keeping tabs on people, all kinds of stuff that you wouldn't want to have. And so the model that United States and more broadly the West would kind of develop in AI, I think, is going to be better for the world in the long run. Now, that said, as we have our own political problems right now, I will just say this about what's going on in the United States, which is another kind of question, is which I also explore in my pieces. But what to my mind is happening now is there is a juncture that Americans in, and that there is a sense, and it's certainly being pushed by Trump and the conservative side, but also it's, I think, probably reasonable to think that a lot of the systems of the last 80 years are getting long in the tooth or kind of less effective than they were in their heyday. And so there needs to either be some kind of dismantling or some kind of evolution from those old systems that, you know, were great in their time in the 20th century, but might have to maybe pass on. And I do think AI and others, technologies are going to provide the opportunity to really fundamentally rethink what we do in this country to provide all the services and tap into everyone and make life better for everybody. And I think that's the juncture in right now, which is very confusing. So we're dismantling the old systems. We're trying to figure out the new systems. We're at a juncture, and our politics is exploding because of that.
Well, you can read about it all on Substack. That is tech expert Peter Lydon, creator of The Great Progression, 2025 to 2050. It's a series of keynote talks and Substack essays. Thank you so much for joining us today, Peter.
It's been great. I'd love to come back.
And coming up on Tech Tuesday, we are, what are users saying about the new Nintendo Switch 2? And also we'll get an update on the CNET tariff tracker. That is when Tech Tuesday from All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Public radio is here for you. It doesn't matter how old you are, how big your home is, or what kind of car you drive. WOSU and NPR connect you to news and information in civil conversations. That's why 43 million Americans listen to NPR each week. WOSU is part of our community, covering and discussing issues important to you, standing with the facts. Meet the moment with WOSU. Go to WOSU.org/protect.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich, and this is Tech Tuesday, a show where we share stories about science, technology, and the future of our environment. The long-awaited Switch 2 has finally hit the market and has some mixed feelings from consumers. And tariffs are still leaving people feeling uncertain, but some companies have come out to announce price increases to their products. Joining us to discuss it all is Russell Hawley, the Director of Commerce Content for CNET. Welcome back to All Sides, Russell.
Thank you.
So the long-awaited Nintendo Switch 2 is finally here. Mario Kart fans are going to be excited. Do you like the new Nintendo Switch 2?
There's certainly a lot to like here. The screen is bigger and brighter. If you have a 4K television, you can connect it to that and, you know, get, you know, kind of a greater visuals, which is all to be expected for something that is an 8-year evolution of the thing that has been very popular, for it to, you know, be lighter, faster, and stronger. That said, there are a couple of pain points that are early users, as well as our own testing crew, have pointed out. The first is that the battery life hovers at around 2 hours, which in some cases is less than you would get.
Yeah.
That's right. In some cases, it would be less than you would get from the original Switch for very similar games. And that battery life will go up and down depending on what games you're playing. So if you have a more graphically intense game, then there's a very good chance that your battery life could be slightly less than 2 hours. However, if you're playing a more casual game in a car while someone else is driving, that battery life in some of our tests has gone up as high as 4 hours. So it very much depends on the kind of game you're playing for the kind of results that you're going to get. But as most of the testing we've done so far, because we are hopeless addicts, is Mario Kart, you can expect around 2 hours of gameplay before you need to either recharge or connect to a battery backup or something like that. The other thing that we've noticed in some of our tests, as well as one of our colleagues at iFixit performed a teardown to confirm, is that the joysticks are very similar to those of the previous Nintendo Switch, which can mean that certain versions of the joystick can engage in something called stick drift, which is an issue where there's a failure within the electronics that makes it so that even though you have, you know, pulled the joystick in one direction, it maybe doesn't go as far as you expect it to. And then it doesn't kind of center up when the joystick comes back, which essentially renders that joystick inoperable and would either need to be replaced via Nintendo's warranty or repaired yourself if you have the know-how to open it up and replace that part.
All right. Well, before we talk about Mario Kart in more detail, let's talk about how much it is. So how much is the Switch 2, and are we paying more in America than other countries?
Nintendo's new Switch 2 is $400 if you buy just the console, and there is currently a bundle pack that allows you to get Mario Kart World added to it, and that is $450, which is cheaper than buying the two separately. And you get, you know, a digital copy of the game that you can, you know, do whatever you want with. This is pretty standard pricing in most places, with the notable exception of Japan, which is where the console is made. If you buy a Japanese version of the Nintendo Switch, you can expect the console to be roughly $100 cheaper. However, do not try and buy one from Japan and have it imported into the US. It will not work the same way that what they call a global version would work here. So there is no, you know, kind of trick to getting around that price. But yes, we are paying roughly $100 more than folks who are buying that same console in Japan.
There was a lot of talk about tariffs impacting the price of the Switch 2. There was a delay in announcing the price because everything kept going back and forth. Do you feel like it's settled down then? Is $450 reasonable for a new gaming system we've been waiting 8 years for?
Yeah, Nintendo America hasn't made any statements about whether we can expect any price fluctuations. So I wouldn't expect that to be something that we experience here in the next little while. It's worth pointing out that as this console was coming out, Microsoft actually announced a $100 price increase on its Xbox consoles, which actually places that console at $100 or more over the cost of the Nintendo Switch. So if you're talking about, you know, whether the price is worth it, I would say that this is competitive when compared to the PlayStation 5 or you know, the current Xbox consoles. However, those consoles have been out for a little bit longer, and I would expect by the time we get to holiday season that the Nintendo Switch will end up being the more expensive of the three, just given how new it is.
Now, back to Mario Kart. I mean, that's what everyone loves. That's what everyone loves to play and be obsessed with. Is it better on the Switch 2?
It is unequivocally better than it is on the original Switch. This new version of the
game
is called Mario Kart World.
Don't tell my son. I'm going to have to buy a new one, so don't tell.
That's right. Yeah, it is. It is all of the things that I personally enjoy about Mario Kart 8, just done on a much larger scale. The games are much larger. The world that you could travel in is much larger. There are far more characters to choose from, and you can race with up to 24 other players. Which is double what you were able to do in the previous version of the game, which if you're very good at the game doesn't mean a whole lot, but if you kind of hover in the middle of the pack when you're racing, it means that you have a whole lot more people to slam things into you in the middle of the game, which can be quite chaotic in cases.
It also has game chat. Is that what it's called? Can you tell us about game chat?
Yeah, so game chat is a function that allows you to do either only audio or audio and video if you have a camera connected to the Nintendo Switch, and it essentially allows you to communicate with a group of players in the same way that most folks would have done prior to this, either through Nintendo's built-in game system through the app that exists on either iOS or Android. It is now just built into the system and allows you to do that. The camera system is interesting if you kind of trust the people that you're with. I don't know that I would go and use it if I was just playing, you know, sort of generally online with random folks. You can plug in a surprising number of different cameras into the Nintendo Switch and have it just up and start working. If you decide you don't want to pay the $80, I think, for the one that Nintendo has made for itself. So if you have, you know, kind of a normal webcam that you would want to use, or even there are some instructions for how to connect your phone and use the camera on your phone to do that instead. It can be fun if you're playing with friends to see their reaction in real time when you have done something terrible to them on a race course, not what I would call a must-have feature for enjoying the game.
Okay, so the game chat and the camera, you do have to buy the camera separately or use something you already have. But then is the point of it, if you are at your house and your friends are all at their other houses, you could see each other when you're playing the game together.
That's right. Yeah, it's just trying to recreate that experience of having four friends on the couch playing the game, minus, you know, accidentally or intentionally dumping a ball of popcorn on someone when they beat you.
All right, I got it. The next thing we were going to talk about is Samsung's new Galaxy Fit 3. So the world is filled with smartwatches and fitness trackers at a wide range of prices, but Samsung's new Galaxy Fit 3 looks to entice customers who don't want to spend hundreds of dollars on a smartwatch. So this watch, I mean, arguably, it looks nice as opposed to other cheaper watches, but how much does this watch cost?
This is a $60 smartwatch, and you will note immediately by looking at it that it is clearly not the same as the other things that Samsung has made before. You know, it's not a round design. It's a little more rectangular. It's quite small, which is actually a good thing. It is frequent complaint about smartwatches is that they do not hold up well, particularly on, you know, female presenting wrists, which are often quite slender. A lot of these watches end up being big and bulky in order to have battery that can, you know, continue for multiple days. This is quite a bit smaller. And you know, as a result of that, you know, has a few features missing that you would expect to see in a modern smartwatch, but is done so, you know, specifically to offer a you know, very budget focused way to, you know, track your performance.
Yeah, but the screen looks just as nice as like my Apple Watch. But if you compare it to something cheap, like a really old Fitbit, it looks great.
Absolutely.
For $60.
Yeah. Yeah, if you're looking for something that will track your steps or you know, riding a bike or doing something like that, I wouldn't expect this to do, you know, particularly complicated like GPS based distance tracking or anything like that, because there's no GPS system built into this, and it's not going to do any of the like mobile app payment systems. So Samsung Pay or Google Wallet or something is not included in this. But if you just want a standard health tracker that will keep an eye on what you're doing and doesn't, you know, require a whole lot of focus or is particularly expensive, this is a really nice option.
Now, it doesn't have a GPS, so does that mean you have to bring your phone with you on a run to track things?
Only if you are interested in tracking total distance. So the Samsung Fit app, which you can put on either an iPhone or an Android phone, it doesn't matter, will first ask you to judge your gait as you go and take steps. And so it can use that to gauge your distance. Once it knows what your standard gait is for running versus walking, then it can provide that distance information. But otherwise, it'll just track, you know, total steps and your heart rate.
Okay. So it does some things. It doesn't do all the fancy things of a smartwatch, but you can't expect it to for $60, right?
That's exactly right. Yeah, this really is, if you just kind of want a bare bones way to kind of keep yourself honest from day to day, the Samsung Fit app does a good job of collecting all of that data and allows you to kind of look at trends over time. The battery life on this is up to 3 days when you have kind of regular activity. And if you've got the ultra battery mode that it has built into it, it claims to last up to 13 days. But recharging in some of our tests was done in as quick as an hour. So if you were to, you know, wear this overnight and then put it on a charger when you were, you know, getting ready for your workday, it would basically be fully charged by the time you were ready to leave the house. So you would effectively have, you know, a smartwatch that you rarely needed to, you know, charge every day.
Do phone calls and text messages pop up on it or no? It's not connected like that.
You do get some notifications on the watch. It is, not the same degree of interactive notifications that you would get with a more advanced version of either Samsung's watch or an Apple Watch, but it will tell you when there are notifications on your watch and, you know, show you what those notifications are.
Okay. This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about tech news with Russell Hawley, Director of Commerce Content at CNET. With everything going on in the world, it might be hard to keep track of prices and whether or not tariffs are making an impact. And recently, CNET conducted a study to look at how consumers are feeling about tariffs and if their purchase habits have changed. What companies so far have said that they will be raising prices related to tariffs?
There are quite a few that have, made, you know, claims over the last couple months, some of which we've talked about before. Best Buy, Macy's, and Mattel have all made statements in the past about, you know, potentially needing to raise prices by the summer. Nikon, the camera company, has made it clear that effective June 23rd, that there would be price hikes specifically for its lenses and accessories, but not necessarily the camera bodies themselves. And then Subaru and Volvo have both made have both already made pretty substantial increases to their prices. Subaru's range is somewhere between $750 and $2,000, depending on the make and model. Mm-hmm. Whereas several Volvo cars have increased by as much as 32%, which in one case specifically, the all electric EX30 raised from $34,000 to $46,000.
That's a lot of money. So are you still tracking? Is CNET still doing its weekly or its, daily update on your tariff tracker? Have you noticed any changes in the past week?
Yeah, so we're making, pretty constant checks, especially as some of these companies during their reporting, are starting to announce, what is likely to be changing and what is not. We're still seeing prices pretty flat when it comes to things like everyday essentials, batteries, and stuff like that that we know are not made here in the US. Mm-hmm. But in line with some of the things that we've seen from some of these other companies that have made announcements, we're expecting some of that to change by the time we get to the end of June.
And what is the significance of the end of June? Is it just how their cycle works with pricing things?
Yeah, it's really just what stock was available here in the U.S. that they were selling through, before new things could arrive at those increased prices.
Well, we had one more topic, but maybe we'll save it to next week. It's the Wyze new bulb camera. Is that how you say it, though? Wyze camera?
Yep. Wyze is the company.
All right. Well, in 30 seconds, we'll just tease it. We can talk about it next week. But it's a security camera that connects to a light bulb, right?
It's a security camera that is also a light bulb that plugs into your outdoor light socket instead of needing its own power source.
Yeah. And basically, does it work? Do you like it?
So far, it works really well. And it's a good way to, to do that kind of thing, to have security in a place where maybe you don't have a lot of space and you just, don't have a lot of options as far as powering it.
Yeah. It's pretty cool. The camera hangs down below the light bulb, so you can just use the same space that already has a light.
That's exactly right.
All right. Well, that was Russell Hawley, Director of Commerce Content at CNET. Thank you so much for your time, Russell.
Thanks for having me.
And this has been Tech Tuesday from All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. I'm Amy Jarevich. If you missed any part of today's show, you can listen on our website, WOSU.org. You can subscribe to the All Sides podcast. And every episode is available to listen to for free in the WOSU mobile app.
Planet Money helps you understand the economy. We find the people at the center of the story.
Garbage in New York, that was like a controlled substance.
We show you how money influences everything.
Tell me what you like by telling me how you spend your money.
And we dig until we get answers.
I had a bad feeling you're going to bring that up.
Planet Money finds out. All you have to do is listen. The Planet Money podcast from NPR.